Hello, this is the No Film School Podcast, and you're listening to Oakley Anderson Moore. Today we're talking about Collective Unconscious, where five emerging directors adapted each other's dreams into five short films and ultimately one fantastic omnibus feature. No Film School's coverage of South by Southwest 2016 is brought to you by Song Freedom. If you're tired of a limited selection of music that's overpriced, or you just can't stomach the generic elevator music anymore, then you need to check out Song Freedom. Register for free to get on their mailing list for the upcoming announcement of thousands of additional songs and a new pricing structure that just might blow your mind. Welcome to the No Film School Podcast. This is Oakley Anderson Moore. We are coming at you live from South by Southwest 2016, and I'm sitting here with an extraordinarily talented group of people who are the filmmakers and creators of Collective Unconscious, which is premiering tonight. We are just recording this on the eve of the world premiere in the narrative competition section of the festival. Thank everyone for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Yay. Thank you.
So the directors of Collective Unconscious, there are five of them. We've got Lily Baldwin, whose work you might know from Sleepover LA, Francis Bodomo from Afronauts, Daniel Patrick Carbone from Hide Your Smiling Faces, Josephine Decker from Thou Wast Mild and Lovely, and Lauren Wolkstein from The Strange Ones. And finally, Dan Schoenbrunn, who you may know from his recent work as the film partnership lead at Kickstarter. Dan, why don't you start us off? I'm going to have you each introduce yourself so that people listening can associate who you are with your voice. Dan, start us off. Let us know who you are and what you did on this project. And because you came up with the idea, just let us know, what is the premise for people at home listening of Collective Unconscious?
Hey, I'm Dan. I like to say that I conducted this project. Couldn't say that I created it, but I think of myself as a conductor, conducting this wonderful, weird orchestra of people sitting with me. I worked for many years at an organization in New York called IFP, which is where I met most of the folks in the room. And my job there was a programmer, and I met so many amazing filmmakers and really saw that a lot of filmmakers, even when they're just starting out and still making short form work, have to agonize for many years just to get behind a camera. And, you know, I feel like a lot of longer form work gets weighed down by commercial interests. So the idea, the genesis of the project was to come up with something that would be fun, experimental, easy enough to do, although maybe we found that that wasn't exactly the case, as these things always go. But I just wanted to do something that would let a bunch of filmmakers who I loved as people and also thought were geniuses do things creative. So we came up with the idea of each of them adapting another one's dreams on film.
Yeah, and so I'd love to hear, when each of you introduce yourself, let us know who you are, what the name of the segment you did, and whose dream it was that you interpreted. Why don't we just go in the order that we're sitting? So start with you, Lauren.
Hi, I'm Lauren Wolkstein. This is my voice. The dream that I adapted is called Bemis, It'll End in Tears. And it is a dream that was Francis Bodomo's dream.
Hi, this is Francis Bodomo. The dream I adapted was Josephine Decker's, and it's called Everybody Dies.
I'm Lily Baldwin, and I made a film called Swallowed, and I adapted Daniel Carbone's dream.
I'm Josephine Decker, and my dream was Lily Baldwin's dream, and the film itself is called First Days Out.
This is Daniel Carbone. I adapted Lauren Wolkstein's dream, and it is called Black Soil, Green Grass.
What's interesting about Collective Unconscious is that this is kind of a historic moment, because there's never been an omnibus film in the narrative competition section before at the festival. So that's pretty cool. Congratulations. Also makes this podcast historic as well. It's the first podcast that's covered an omnibus film in the narrative competition section.
Yeehaw.
So what was the process like? Dan, you got all these guys together, and then how many of you knew the person whose dream you were going to be interpreting, and how many of you didn't know and were just starting fresh with this material?
When we were given the dream statements, we didn't know whose dream it was at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So we kind of had to, I was guessing. I was
so
trying to figure
anonymous.
It out. Anonymous, yeah. Oh.
Lauren said to me, I think I know whose dream I have. It's either Josephine's or Lily's. The only person it's definitely not is Francis's. But it was
Francis's. Was very wrong.
And I think we figured it out because you're like, milk.
You were posting pictures of yourself like drinking milk and like cameras in your mouth and stuff. So
process of deduction.
I tried to keep them from knowing whose dream they had. And I think the original idea was for you guys not to know until it actually like premiered, until the first time you watched it. And I didn't want like Dan having an image of Lauren dreaming it in his head while he was adapting it, because it wasn't really about like a faithful adaptation. It was about using the dream as like a jumping off point to make something surreal and all of their own. But we also got to a point logistically when we decided to turn the film into a feature where we needed to start working together and watching each other's films. And at that point, they found out.
Yeah, and I'd love to go into more specifically each person's, like, what their strategy was to accomplish the dream that they were given. But I'm curious to know, so when you started, it wasn't necessarily going to be woven into a feature. So when you started, you know, what changed over the course? When did you decide it would be a feature? And, like, did you have to change some things where you're like, oh, we need to make something consistent, or, you know, let's fire the guy that did this and reshoot him to do that, or...
Yeah, well, originally this was going to be 6 films and one person isn't here. I'm just kidding. No.
We really love each other.
We set out to do this project, and the whole idea was that we would make whatever we could with whatever we had to make it with. And we did a Kickstarter campaign together and raised $25,000. So everyone got $5,000 to make their film. And I had no expectations that when you give somebody $5,000, they're going to come back at you with a, you know, even like 5-minute long short. And that was fine with me. The whole idea was just kind of like, let's see what we get and then think about what form it takes when it gets out into the world. When all of these guys hustled and some of them raised additional funds and everyone just kind of like called in 100 favors, and made really ambitious, amazing films that we realized could play well as a feature together. And I think we felt creatively they kind of complemented each other in interesting and not forced ways, we decided to turn it into a feature.
Not to throw you under the bus, Dan, but I do remember the moment when the 5 minutes started to become like, can you guys each get like 10 or 12 minutes, do you think? Because we're going to maybe do the feature thing and it just needs to be long enough. And we were all like, gosh, that significantly reduces the per second dollar count.
Yeah, so let's start. I mean, I'm going to start with you, Daniel, because as I recall, your section is the first to appear. So I just would love to hear like what you, like the dream as you read it, you know, tell us what that meant. And then like, what was your strategy? How did you decide what you, you know, paint us a little picture of how you decided to make yours based on that.
So my dream statement, revolved around basically, a couple of people in a room fearful of the others around them. And there was a bit of like a pop culture element, at least that's how I sort of interpreted it. And I didn't immediately, feel much reading it. There was something, it just sort of didn't appeal to my sensibilities usually, the way I kind of imagine things and the way I imagine like how people describe their dreams. It was very somewhat nicely. It was very like kind of had its own built-in narrative. But I wanted to kind of take the elements I liked and the elements I wasn't so crazy about. And we were very much encouraged to, you know, toss things aside. It was like a tweet length. So my film ended up being 18 minutes. So, it's expanded significantly on that initial statement. But what I did respond to was sort of the central conflict of these people, sort of in a place that is familiar to them, but it feels sort of otherworldly because of some outside influence, which I took from what was called a podcast in the dream statement. I turned into this sort of, omnipresent piece of audio in the world. Going back, actually, it is quite similar in a lot of ways to the dream statement, sort of conflict wise and sort of thematically, but I imagine it doesn't look anything like Lauren's actual dream experience.
That is my dream now. I forget completely what my original dream was. It's just Carbone's film.
Josephine, how about you? What did you react to your dream statement? And, you know, what was your strategy? What were you trying to explore?
Well, it's interesting. Unlike the rest of these guys, I think I really knew immediately that I had Lily's because I had seen her work and I knew. What am I trying to say? I think we have kindred brains. So I was like, I think this is Lily's. And it was mostly the syntax, actually. It was like the way that the thought, it was more like a poem than a narrative, very different from Dan's experience. So I kind of figured, oh, I can kind of go any direction. Like I can, cause there were a lot of images and I was like, okay, I have spent the last 5 years working with this really cool artist residency program and This past summer, we did a lot of work with response pieces. So you see someone else's work, and very quickly you make your own piece that is responding to it. And so in a way, it was interesting because of the dream statement, I immediately felt like it gave a lot of permission, partly because of the way that the wording was very fluid. So I was just like, awesome. It was like a launching point. And I was like, great, I'm making a response piece to this dream. And then felt a lot of freedom, I guess. And my piece is about men coming out of prison and the surrealness of that feeling of the first days out when like garbage smells good, you know, or music in the streets, just walking by a car playing music feels like, you know, heaven. So I think that there was an energy and exuberance and sort of like something defying expectation that I felt in the dream that I think hopefully I captured in the film.
You know, and in your piece, there's a lot of movement of a lot of things, but in particular of the camera, and it's like very exhilarating. Can you speak to that? And then also what you did to achieve that? It was interesting, very interesting looking.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because I incubated actually. It took a long time to get the audio documentary material just because it's hard. It's not that easy to gain access to a bunch of people who've just come out of prison. It's kind of, you're not like, oh, I'll just call up my six friends or not. I mean, actually there are plenty of people who could do that. But my community is not necessarily one that happens in that much. So,
you actually got that audio material specifically for the short.
For this. Okay, yeah. Cool. So, but that took like kind of months to get. And then, I was working with that material at this residency, kind of wondering like, what am I going to put on top of this? I knew I wanted to do like live action animation sort of feeling. I love animation, but I'm not an animator. So I like things that feel like that fluidity. And then I immediately was going to this dance film residency, which I highly recommend to all film schooler, no film schoolers, called Experimental Film Virginia, where it's not that they fund you making a film, but they bring all the people together so that you being there, it's very easy to make a film. So you have dancers flown in from all over the world, incredible locations, and then like a high school costume closet. So there's like a little part of me that's like, the costumes are a little 90s, but you know, they were free in the high school costume closet. That was kind of what I had access to. And it was very exhilarating to kind of have just gotten that documentary material and then be thrust in this environment with a bunch of dancers. And I honestly didn't think that would be the final product. I thought I would do something else in New York. And we did do other shoots in New York, but the dance stuff felt really energetic, I guess. And I think partly because I didn't think it was the final product, I gave myself a lot of freedom and liberty around it. And that was, I don't know, it was hard to match the kind of liberty that I sensed in the filmmaking and in the performers later with planning, which is a thing I've come up against when I try to make movies. It's like, I love to not plan. But it's nice to have a combination of both.
All right, Lily, how about you? How did you react to your dream statement? What was your strategy?
No, first of all, this whole project and the premise that Dan set up was super, super exciting because it was a place for me to just be the weirdo that I feel like I am and not have to hold myself back or try to fit or make sense into anything. For me, it was about pushing risk. And that's everyone that I worked with. I said, what haven't you done that you want to do? Let's put that here. Like, let's make this be a platform for pushing, whether it's like, you know, the costume or the performers or Dahmer, the DP, or Michael, the other actor. So, you know, I knew I wanted to just explore some darker, more raw space because I'm sick of dance being pretty and graceful. And I wanted physicality to deal with a gnarlier sort of subterranean space. So I had some ideas that were percolating already around just like pushing horror and fear. And then I got this dream and I was like, I've never drunk that much milk in my life, nor have I had a parasite. And I'm not a fan of like gory horror. So I just feel like, how am I going to climb inside of this? And knowing that, you know, Dan said like, basically do whatever the fuck you want. And I thought, wow.
I think that was the exact email.
All
and
caps.
I kept it. I was like, no, wait, really? Wait, and he was like, yeah. And I was like, wow. So, I mean, I have to say it was really exciting to be with these people that I felt like are a little more traditional and everyone has this like different things under their belt. I was like, wow, I get to just be a part of this group and do what I do. And so within that kind of space of containment of like risk and also safety, there was a safety to be with these guys because I felt really honored to be a part of it. Dan's dream was really specific. It was like a moment. And I was really into it because I, like at the dream I gave Josephine, it was this sort of like slots of imagery. And that's the way I think, is like slices of life, which is why I love soap operas. I'm like, it's like, bam, like jump in. And you're like, just want to like take all of these slices. But I don't, congruity is hard for me, just my brain. So Dan's was super like ABC. So I thought, okay, I'm going to make this the apex of the film. And I want to get there and I want to follow it. So I thought, like, why would this be happening? So what's the story around this? So I built this sort of epic thing that kept growing. And I was like, oh, shit, this is like, and then this happened and this has to happen. And then we're doing this. And so the last line was, and then I was filled with regret. And I was like, ooh. So I took the concept of a parasite as a swallowed truth. And I thought, what is this like conceptually? And not, it doesn't have to be in the film, but I knew as the director and like writing, it's like, what is this thing that you don't say that just starts growing inside of you, that starts eating and living off of you inside? And do you kind of get off on it? Or does it like, is it just sort of this beautiful, ugly, gross? Are you proud of it? So I had all these ideas, and also being in it, I was like, it's kind of freaky. It was a pretty intense process. But I was working some amazing people on it that I could trust and lean into. So I spent a lot of time rehearsing with people and like setting them up and giving them this sort of physicality or sensibility that they could access. And I, again, could kind of conduct using Dan's word on set. Say like, okay, like in the party scene, I did a lot of that from inside. I'm like, don't look at me. I'm going to give you direction and then turn a camera. So sort of this crazy sort of split authorship. Yeah, it was great. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, definitely. You know, before I move on to Francis, you know, you mentioned how you kind of were treating this, you know, you were exploring and experimenting. I was wondering if, as a group, do you guys feel, I mean, this is a feature, but each of you came up with your own integral short form, you know, part of it. Was that something that the rest of you felt? Or was this something you felt you could, you know, this format was conducive to exploration and experimentation?
Definitely. I think it's all in how Dan structured what this was going to be. I think, because I was trying to remember how we came to the final film from the dream statement that I got with my producers and co-writer the other day. And it's impossible, but it's only impossible because we were able to stay emotionally loyal to like what the dream statement evoked for us without naming it immediately and saying what it's going to be and pitching it and like making it something before it became something. So yeah, it was definitely a chance to experiment and definitely process-wise too, because I also went through like sort of asking people how, like what kind of work they'd done that they hadn't done that they wanted to do, and also what they felt was missing from the way that they had made movies before this movie, and it was really fulfilling. Yeah,
Francis, we'd love to hear, tell us about your dream statement, how you reacted to it, and you know, your process. Everybody dies.
Yeah. The final film ended up being the Grim Reaper hosting a public access TV show in which she's reaping the bodies of black children coming in from like systemic violence. I read the dream statement. Yeah, it's so many leaps and bounds. But it was like, I read the dream statement and it wasn't one of the more narrative ones. It was very evocative and poetic and tender. But also the last line, no water, only black tea, just felt like very uncaring compared to the dream, everything that had come before it, which was so detailed and close. So the thing that definitely stuck with me emotionally was that there was this unrelenting tenderness in a really uncaring world. And so just like the juxtaposition of those two things. And of course, at the time, I was like, okay, I'm going to stay open and see what comes to me. And at the time, it was like last year, where by June, there'd been only 9 days when there hadn't been like a police brutality case that had been reported. So of course that was in my mind. And immediately that was like, oh, it feels like that. Like, we're all tired of hearing this. We're all like tender and emotional. And the numbers like uncaringly just keep rising. And trying to explore what that does to emotions when, because you can't be that intense all the time. Like, so we all become sort of apathetic, or we try and look away and we try and close down. And basically I just took that juxtaposition, and it was like, so it's like this TV show, this game show, which is like gonna be like high emotion, high affect, like it's never going to change no matter what's happening. Like, it's going to be like, welcome to Everybody Dies. And like, no matter what comes in and how horrible it is, it's going to be this really happy, like great American superstructure. And we're going to have this Grim Reaper character who's been in this for millennia. Because the other part of it was like, we're hearing this now, but this has been going on forever. And if we're going to bring genocide into it and all this stuff, like, then she's pretty tired at this point. So it's like, take that high emotionality and make it routine. And basically, I guess what that did for us in making the film was that at every point in the process, it was always questioning what was canned and what was like emotional and tender, and juxtaposing them and seeing what it felt like. And with every collaborator, I remember it was always like, we would just try it and then we'd be like, ooh, that's it. That made us feel weird. That made us feel uncomfortable. And just using that process to get to the final film, which to this day still makes me very uncomfortable, which is a very different feeling I receive. That was sort of like, I guess with my other films, I'm like, oh yeah, I did that. It's done. And I know what that was. And this one, I feel very uncomfortable and on edge still with it, which I think is a very wonderful thing to be able to experiment towards. And
it's actually interesting to hear that, because I feel similarly. And I also feel like I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going with this. So that's all. I just feel the same, and it's nice to hear you say that, because I feel like
you feel uncomfortable watching it differently than previous works, where you're the concept and everything's been entirely in your control.
I definitely feel that too. Mm-hmm. It was something that was like completely like just wild. Mm-hmm. It was just like whatever came out of it came out of it. Mm-hmm. And it was not in my control, really, in how I saw it.
So I also wonder if it also has something to do with like, for me at least, I have made documentaries and I've made very, very, very personal fiction. And and this is not my story necessarily, working with people in prison. So, you know, it's like there's so much, I feel like it's touching the edge of something that I don't totally even feel like I get to be the one to comment on. And yet it feels so fucking personal in a way, you know? I like it when someone said, like, a vote for no one is a vote for Donald Trump, is like something that I heard someone say recently. And I kind of feel like a similar thing about these kind of issues that we're trying to look at in these pieces is just like, if you're not talking about mass incarceration, are you just kind of being like, all right, yeah, let's throw some people in there for like life. So, but it's just so weird. But then it's like, how do you have that conversation? So blah, blah, blah.
All right, let's finish it off with you, Lauren. Okay. What was your dream statement?
How did you react to it, and what was your strategy?
Sure. Well, first, I was really so excited and honored to be a part of this group, super group of amazing people that I admire and respect. And I was really thrilled to be given a chance to just experiment and just not like worry about, you know, having to achieve any sort of financial, you know, make something for somebody else that expected something from us. And it was just completely like whatever came to your mind, make it. And there doesn't have to be any logical reason behind it, which was really important for me, because all of my work up until now has been very much based in narrative, story, cause and effect, logical sense, and grounded in realism. And this gave me a chance to just, my rule with making this was whatever images came to my mind, I would just explore that and not try to make any sense about it. Which was hard for me and very difficult. I remember writing the script and kept thinking, well, I don't know if I should do, this doesn't quite add up. I don't know if I should go this way, but I feel like this is a dream I would have. And so that back and forth discussion with myself, ultimately, I was happy that I did go the route of just like making something that was visually something that I could see in a dream, but not quite making sense of it. I don't know how anybody could give notes on that, but Dan actually gave great notes for the script that didn't quite make sense. My script that didn't make sense. Going back to the dream statement that I received, at first I was for several weeks, I was just confused and like, I was just like, Dan, why did you give me this dream? I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I don't know how to adapt it. Cause it was very, it was about the end of the world, which is huge. And it's about a volcano that's erupting inside a gym class in high school. And I was like, whoa, how do I start? So for a while I was like, we got to shoot near a volcano. We have to, or maybe for one of my things that I thought of was, well, maybe we could just have kids like pretending that they're making volcanoes, or I just didn't know where to begin. And then after a while, I just decided not to be so literal with it and just think about being back in high school and being in gym class and being really uncomfortable and being really anxious. And I think that was the core, I hope that was the core of Francis's dream of this idea that our bodies are changing in high school. And what do you do if you don't feel like you're in the right body? And so that's where I came at it from and started thinking about the coach kind of controlling this class with a kid, one of the students who doesn't feel like he should be in the locker room that he's in. He was born female and doesn't feel like, you know, that he should be in one locker room versus another locker room. Because in high school, I just think of girls versus boys locker rooms. And so I wanted to kind of explode the gender norms with this film. And so that's where I started. That's where I started the concept of trying to think of the volcano as erupting the gender norms from high school. So then I was really happy that I got that, that dream statement. After I decided that the volcano wasn't I didn't have to take it literally.
Song Freedom was the first and only music licensing company to offer top 40 hits from every major record label and publisher to event filmmakers. Now they're creating something special for all kinds of filmmakers. If you're tired of a limited selection of music that's overpriced, or you just can't stomach the generic elevator music anymore, then you need to check out Song Freedom. Register for free to get on their mailing list for the upcoming announcement of thousands of additional songs and a new pricing structure that will blow your mind in just 2 weeks. Once you're registered with Song Freedom, you'll also get news about their next big giveaway of over $50,000 in free gear and other products. Go to songfreedom.com and register today. It's incredibly easy. Dan, maybe you can speak to this. So when you decided that these were going to be combined into features, there's a really cool unifying extra material that you shot to connect these all that I think is going to be so fun when people, after we record this and go tonight to watch the premiere, are going to watch this in theaters. It's really cool because it really plays with the idea of you're sitting in the theater, but also relating that to, you know, the dream state and whatnot. What was the idea? Who came up with that? Was that you? And how did you decide that to make that the unifying force?
So as we were working on our individual films, and as we decided and realized that this could be feature length, I kind of deputized Carbone and Lauren to think tank and figure out what will be the tissue that surrounds this whole thing. And yeah, you know, going in, I think like we agonized over it quite a deal and had a lot of long conversations before we actually arrived at even the concept of what it would be. It's complex and there were a lot of things to think about because, well, first of all, like we did a Kickstarter campaign. We did a lot of press. All of our friends and community know that this is a film about people adapting each other's dreams because we say that a lot. But if somebody watches this film in 20 years, hopefully, they might not know that unless we explain that. But when you explain that and literalize that, it kind of becomes Project Greenlight and it kind of becomes like this Exquisite podcast. Corpse and and you know the magic kind of is gone. But so we needed it to be expositionary, We also needed it to kind of like calibrate. I say it like kind of calibrates the weird. There's like a lot of very strange, surreal voices in this film. And part of what I think is great about it is that they're so diverse and different and talking about different things. But if you're going on that journey, that structure of the film can kind of like take you through this sea of weird or these different doorways into different dreams. So yeah, we thought a lot about like how narrative should it be? What should it be? Should there be like a host? Is this like the Twilight Zone and it's Rob Serling? And I don't know if Dan and Lauren, you want to talk about what we eventually and what you guys arrived at and made there.
Sure. Yeah. This was actually I had finished my short for a while when we were doing this. So it was a weird, sort of re-immersion into this whole project. And then this film Collective Unconscious as a whole has become this ever morphing, like love hate thing for me, mostly love, but, this was actually almost harder, I think, than doing my short, because we had nothing but freedom for the shorts, and we sort of all went our separate ways and came back with films. And Dan was kind of involved a little bit with each film as we were shooting, but it was sort of like, you know, here's the money from Kickstarter, go do your thing. I can't wait to see a rough cut. And this was like, okay, here's the pieces we have. It was harder because we knew what we had. And we knew what was needed. So suddenly we found ourselves with these sort of parameters that we weren't used to working with. And they are five of the most different shorts I can think of. There's docs, there's dancing, mine's black and white, there's color, there's four different aspect ratios and formats. And it's really a wild thing to see all put together. So we were trying to find something that wouldn't overshadow. There's the format of an omnibus film where there's like a recurring narrative that you get a piece of between each film. And then it's like, but then doesn't that kind of make the film about that narrative, not these shorts? So we threw that idea out, and eventually we just came up with the idea of kind of how can we sort of put ourselves in this dream state and kind of lull the audience into the same feeling that we had while making this process and into a headspace that we think is appropriate for an audience to watch the film. So, We hired a hypnotherapist, Dan Ryan, one of the most amazing people I've met. We had a quick meeting with him at his
a real hypnotherapist
that I think Lauren, friend of mine,
who recommended him to us. And actually, I think it was your idea, Carbone, where you were saying, "Why don't we try to hypnotize everyone, or you know, like hypnotize our actors or something?" Right. There was something involved with hypnosis.
I think it was Herzog's
Heart of Glass. Yeah, where Herzog had hypnotized his cast and crew while making the film. And so it has this like trance state when you watch the film, you feel like you're in it with them. So when Dan mentioned that movie, I was like, oh, I know a hypnotherapist we could talk to. And then I emailed Dan Ryan, and then we were like, well, how do we do this? And an idea was to get all of us together, all five of us together, and hypnotize all of us and film it.
We also went to see Dan Ryan, who's, I think, like in a lot of ways, like the host of this film. He takes you through it in a strange way. We went to see him in his office, and none of us had met him before, and learned he'd traded emails with him. And we just like sat with him, and he just talked to us for like an hour about,
and we were hypnotized,
what he does and hypnotism. And yeah, he just kind of put us into this insane trance, and we came out of that meeting at like 1 p.m. on a Friday in like Manhattan, and it was sunny out.
We were
winded and feeling really strange.
What did we just go through? And it was just like an introductory meeting.
Pretty much we're like, we were pretty much just like, we need that. That is the film.
Yeah. Yeah, he spent a lot of time talking about cinema and how different screens put you in a trance of different, yeah. Like, you know, he made us rethink what a trance means and how often we're actually in a trance.
More often
the day
than we
while
think.
We're awake.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, that's it. That's what he's got to talk about. So he kind of lulls you into a dream state, talks about the screen that you're looking at. So I'm actually really excited to see this on a large screen with an audience, because that section really is for the people in the audience. And I think it plays, interestingly enough, for something that sort of started as kind of like a quote unquote web series, I think it's now, I think, a theatrical experience because of this.
Yeah. Incredibly cinematic, I think. Yeah. And to me, what I would say about those statements, those sections and how they pull together the film, is I think that like each piece is so wonderfully like immersive and does take you inside of it in a strange way and reprograms the way that you think about and watch films in a way that is really reflective of the dream state and the spirit of like not quite being conscious, but being able to kind of like follow these strange patterns and paths. And that was the goal, I think, of this project from the beginning. and what Dan Ryan does in the film and what he kind of like espouses is just that's what cinema is. And that's what dreams are. And like that relationship between those two things, I think, is the core of what this project has been about.
And just to kind of parlay onto that, you know, I feel like there's also by your choice to do this, which you're engaging the audience. There's like a performance, and having been a live performer for many years, I feel like there's this element of like proscenium space that's really interesting. That isn't, it's like expanding sort of the theatrical concept, which is inviting you, yes, you, to feel something, you know, by looking at you. And I like that sort of responsibility too. I feel like we're asking something of the audience, and I'm kind of proud of that.
But speaking of how different everyone's films were, like in no film school, we always, it's like always so interesting to see the different tools that people use to achieve what they wanted. I mean, we've got like a TV access look, you know, black and white, you know, who shot on what? You guys can just shout out, like, what did you use to shoot, to create the stuff that you did?
Amira. We shot on the Amira.
Tiny little black magic camera with a steady cam. Smallest camera I've ever used.
Really?
Huh.
We did the red with a pass onto VHS and then back to digital.
Oh, so
we
boy. Went.
Did you actually do a formal pass onto VHS?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was like an after effect. I love that.
I mean, there's a lot of after effects and like visual effects, but there was a pass at some point.
So you actually have like a VHS master possibly?
Yeah. I mean, it looks not good.
That's cool.
Amira.
C300 Canon.
Cool. Did you guys shoot in black and white as you did it, or did you just keep that in mind to play around in post? Or did you know you were going to make it black and white?
I'm sure you knew. I knew it was going to be monochromatic. I was trying to actually for a while. I'll give a quick little shout out to the Digital Bolex folks. They have a monochrome camera that I was really, really, really trying to use, and didn't end up working out in the end. There's actually one shot in the film shot on the monochrome Digital Bolex, but we monitored in black and white, and it was always going to be black and white. I mean, it was shot in color and it had to be desaturated, but on set, everything was black and white.
So with this type of omnibus film, it's so new, yet no one's done that. No one's been in narrative competition. Is this something other filmmakers can duplicate? Like was this something that like you would do again, or was this meaningful or useful in your career to what you're going to make next? And like, what have you learned that you could pass on to other filmmakers that might see what you did and be like, I want to do that?
Well, I think the collective spirit of making this film is really important for us as filmmakers to understand why we're making films, and the people that we make it with is why we make the films that we make. And I think that really invigorated me as a filmmaker to continue making work like this. And I hope it does spark people, other filmmakers, to come together and use their resources collectively to make films.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I loved leaning into these guys and just sort of knowing that it was not just me sort of spearing my own vision, which can be a little tedious sometimes, tooting my own horn. And so I just knew that I could, like, I had this sort of buffer of people that I respected around me. And it was like a safety net to be myself, if that makes any sense. And I would completely support it and would love to do it again. And feel like everyone should make their own version of this.
They're like, no, I would never do this again.
I would definitely do it again. And I feel like in my dreams, there's like Collective Unconscious, like season 2, 3, 4. Yeah. I mean, future 4, 5, 6. only because I feel like it's a sign that, and there's an alternative. This whole, like, making this film was kind of a healing process for me, to put it in those terms, because I had just come out of this, like, the best version of, like, the short film narrative, which is, like, you make a short, it goes to a great festival, and suddenly you're supposed to be catapulted into this, like, new level of your filmmaking. And I felt like Lauren and I actually had just come out of making branded content for this really big company that were NDA signed not to be able to mention, but like, it was like they had no regard for the work we were doing as filmmakers, and then they never released it. So I was coming out of like feeling like 8 months of work had just like gone away. Yes. And it was so just to be able to move away from like, you have a great short and then maybe you do branded content and into like, there's spaces. Yeah, exactly. There's spaces where you can continue to experiment, and maybe that's what the short film actually is, because we're in this time where we're trying to monetize them in this like very specific way. I think just remembering that there is experimentation, trying things out, finding your footing, things that people try and knock out of you to become the most like professional filmmaker are actually things that are very, like you said, sort of resisting the idea that you have to plan everything before you get there. I think this is what I wish was asked of newer filmmakers, like explore what you're doing, like find your footing as opposed to label your voice, find your niche, make your film, next festival, you know, so.
Yeah, I describe this process as it just made me feel like a kid again. I mean, it's kind of cliche as that sounds, but it, not necessarily in like, oh, we're running and playing, but like, just like, I don't care about audience. I mean, I love the audience, but I don't care about who watches it. As long as someone watches it, I don't need to give anyone their money back. I didn't personally invest tens of thousands of dollars, and I'm constantly thinking about that when I should be thinking about the script and the, and it was like, yeah, I can just like do your thing, pick up a camera, take your friends out to the woods, you know, have a good time. And then, and oddly enough, those projects where you have sort of the least stakes going in are the ones that get seen by the most people. And that's always really reassuring. It's like, oh, the way that you're banging your head against the wall trying to get another screenplay out, and this person wants to read it and this person doesn't like it, and so maybe put this in it so that these people might give you some funding, blah, 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 all that nonsense. That doesn't need to be the case. I mean, we're not going to live off of this movie, but you know, who cares? I don't know. I feel like this project attracted a certain group of people that, above all else, just want to make really good work, and kind of, at least speaking personally, kind of wish I was more naive to the way the film industry works. Because those are the kinds of films that I like to make. And wonderfully, those also apparently are the kinds of films people want to see. It was a very refreshing kind of thing to be doing between larger projects.
It's like re-energizing the joy of filmmaking, and not the business of filmmaking.
Reminds us why we make what we make.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do think that personal work can be really, really successful. And I think what was kind of nice for me with this project is like, I was a dancer when I was a kid, but I haven't really been involved in dance since, but I love it. And I got to make a dance film, so that I have no technical experience, but I just did that. And then also I made a project about incarceration where I'm not an expert. And I like took a long time to get the documentary material because I was building all those relationships around this. But that's, I guess, that the feeling of being a kid, basically like the fact that when you're a kid, you get to be like, I love dinosaurs. I'm going to learn everything about dinosaurs for 6 months. And now, no, I love sailing. I'm a sailor. I'm going to be a sailor when I grow up. And that, because in film, you kind of get your niche and you work on the same issue for 2 years sometimes. And like, everyone's like, oh, we've got to get her because she's been researching that for 2.5 years. And it's almost like if you haven't poured 8 years of stuff into something, then you don't get into the labs, you don't, you know, people don't fund your movie. And so, I think that this does prove that there's a space for, it's just that adults need to grow and play as much as kids do.
Maybe more so.
Maybe more so.
And, you know, just to end out our podcast, maybe Dan, just having facilitated all of this, where do you hope to see Collective Unconscious going? Where do you think it'll eventually live? And then also your advice, you know, they just gave like their impressions of the effect, you know, give us your advice too as a facilitator, how to encourage other people to do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously hard because like logistically there are like cash needs to making film and it's not a cheap medium to work in, but I'm just like, whenever I see an article that's like, there are too many films, like we need to like, it's economics, make less films and they'll all be great and just put all of our energy into that. Like, I'm just a big supporter of like, just make work. And like the joy of seeing this film come together for me was like, that's all I need is like, yeah, we all put a lot into it, but like we made something cool and crazy and fun and that's great. And I think that like filmmakers are just way too precious and guarded about what they do and when they do it. And yeah, it's like you make that first film and you're perceived in a certain way. And then it's just like, my next move has to be perfect. No, like just go out with a camera and make something weird. I thought that like this model of people doing it together and supporting each other through it was like more likely to like make that a fun, enriching process. And I think it also like bought us a little bit of like power in that we weren't just like one crazy person trying to make a dream. We were a team of people making dreams.
We are one crazy person, actually.
So yeah, I mean, I think that like banding together and just for the purpose, not of like making something that's going to be this great commercial product, but just for the purpose of like having a community that's making fun work is like something that every filmmaker, whether they're in college or grad school or, you know, 30 films in, can think about doing. The weird thing about this process also has been that like, we haven't thought too specifically about what it would be until we're at the stage for it to be that. And, you know, one thing I'm proud of with the feature is that like, it's a feature because it's a feature. And like, we didn't like try to force a square into a round peg or whatever that statement is. Like it found itself, I think. And I hope that a similar thing will happen with releasing the film, and that I think we all happily agree that like, because this project has been weird and experimental, like it's not about like maximizing the commercial value of the project. And honestly, I think that like in our country that doesn't really appreciate experimentation in art, like the commercial value is quite small. But that doesn't mean there's not huge value and like artistic value here. And I think that the goal for all of us is just like getting this out to as many people who want to see this kind of weird shit as possible. And what's the art, what's the creative and fun way we can make that release happen that it feels like an extension of the spirit of what this entire project has been.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much. It's been a real honor to have you here. The time people listen to this, the film will have premiered, but as of right now, it's happening tonight. So I just want to say break a leg tonight and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you guys.
You can find more No Film School podcasts like our Indie Film Weekly, a weekly recap of everything important in independent film that week, on iTunes, Pocket Cast, anywhere you find this kind of thing, we're there. We're new to the podcast scene, so check us out, subscribe, rate us, give us feedback, and thank you for listening.